Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast 137. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing a trilogy of movies from the late 1950s and mid-1960s, which were quite influential in the genre of science fiction. The first one is The Fly, the 1958 version, starring Vincent Price and David Hedison. Then we're going to Return of the Fly from 1959 and Curse of the Fly from 1965, all three of them in one podcast. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll start scrambling some atoms. Martian Driving Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of science fiction, horror, fantasy, film appreciation. It doesn't matter when it comes from, whether it's old or new, in black and white, in colour, 3D, anamorphic, it doesn't matter. If it's interesting, I'm going to give it a go. Now, there are occasionally also roundtable discussions where I get a few like-minded cronies around and we talk about science fiction, of horror, or fantasy, or anything that takes our mind. So the format's kind of loose. Now, you can contact me and leave feedback via feedbackpaleo, that's feedback, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and have a chat there with me and other people about science fiction, fantasy, horrors, or any other kind of things you want to talk about. Apart from politics, I've got another area for that. Please be aware that this podcast does have swearing in it. So if you're going to be listening to it on speakers, make sure there are no children around, unless you want them to learn wider vocabulary than they already have. Hey, how's everybody going? Have I mentioned how much I fucking hate winter? It's cold and it's windy outside and I don't like it one tiny bit. We haven't been doing much in the last couple of weeks, mostly because it's school holidays and you don't want to go to anywhere public during school holidays because the places are full of rugrats. You can't go to the zoo, you can't go to the cinema very easily, though we did go and see Ant-Man and the Wasp, and that was full of kids, so fuck that. And so what you do is you hunker down and just wait for the rugrats to go back to school. That's the only thing you can possibly do to make life bearable. So school holidays ends tomorrow, so there should be more things on my agenda at that stage, including a meetup with good friend of the podcast, Morris. And I'm also guesting on a couple of podcasts. I'm going to be doing The Projection Booth with Mike White, and I'm going to do Love That Album. So I've got a fairly busy month up ahead as far as outsourcing my voice to other podcasts. And that's going to be fun because it gets me out of that comfort zone of just doing my stuff and being utterly selfish about the way I approach it. So good for me. The only other thing that really got happening, and I just hit something with my arm, which I wasn't expecting, is that Sal and I are planning to go to Japan in about a year's time. We're going to save up our pennies and head to Tokyo, maybe one other city. We haven't quite nailed down exactly what we're going to do, but we are going to Japan. Probably end up doing about maybe 10 days to 2 weeks there and hitting all the high spots, buying a lot of stuff we don't need, which is what we always do when we go on any trip, anytime, anywhere. But I'm kind of looking forward to it. Haven't done any international travel for a very long time now. And now's the time to do it. We're going to be going just before the World Cup of Rugby is in Tokyo. So we're going to do it ahead of the madness of rampaging football fans. And fortunately, I've got a friend who's a travel agent. So he's going to fix us up with all the stuff we need for that. We're going to be getting our passports this year. We're going to be getting our passports actually in a few weeks to have them ready. And so another adventure, which is not a bad thing at all. And looking forward to that. Sal wants to buy tons and tons of cute stuff in Japan. And so it gives us a kind of something to look forward to in the medium distance. And I'm looking forward to that. I'll probably end up buying a whole bunch of DVDs and Blu-rays, but that's not a downside really, is it? So yeah, that's happening. I'll keep you updated on the plans for that. But looking forward to it. It'll be a good thing for us. So given that the weather has been utterly shit, I have been watching a few things. So what have I been watching? There's a 1950s British crime movie, which is kind of not at the top end of the British crime movies, but it's called Tiger and the Smoke, and it starred Donald Sinden, Miriam Pavlo, and Tony Wright. And it's about a criminal gang, a guy returning from the war, and he gets involved with them while his wife has a treasure at a house that she has in France. It's kind of a little bit of a dog's breakfast. It's set, they kind of keep down the production costs by setting it during an enormously dense London fog of the type that they had in the 1940s and 1950s. And so you can have cheap sets and even just suggest the sets in some cases. It's kind of not terribly good, but it was kind of interesting just to kind of fill out the gap in my knowledge of British crime films. The bad guy is a kind of blonde, good-looking, cast-against-type sort of actor called Tony Wright, who has a switchblade, which is always a nice thing to have in a movie. And, yeah, it ends on a cliffhanger, literally. They do have a fight at the top of a cliff while trying to protect the treasure involved. I'm not going to spoil what that is because it's a little bit counterintuitive what the treasure is. But, yeah, well, it wasn't bad. It wasn't good. It was okay. Then I went to a television movie from the 1970s, which kind of hung on the blaxploitation genre a little bit, and it's called Get Christie Love, starring Teresa Graves, Harry Gardino, and Louise Sorrell. It's really weird because Harry Gardino plays the police chief to Teresa Graves' titular character, who's a police detective looking for a missing child and the secret to a criminal gang's money laundering deal. And Harry Gardino's hitting on this woman who works for him all the time in some not very subtle ways. It's crazily wrong for a lot of reasons. Teresa Graves is kind of cool playing the hero. She gets to fight people and kick ass and take names and do all that kind of stuff. And it did spin off a short-lived TV series, but the sleaziness of her police chief really fucked that up for me. Didn't enjoy that terribly much at all. One of the other things I saw was a movie called Colour Me Dead, which was the last feature film for Tom Tryon, who went on to be an author and wrote a couple of good horror novels. And it's Colour Me Dead is a remake of DOA, and the odd thing about it is it's set in Sydney and on the Gold Coast in Australia. There was a guy called Reginald Goldsworthy who had cut a deal to make a few kind of television-type movies for the US market. They imported American movie stars, in this case Tom Tryon and Carolyn Jones and Rick Jason, who were kind of, Carolyn Jones of course had been Morticia Adams on the Adams Family. Rick Jason was in a TV series called Combat, and they basically remade DOA in Sydney and on the Gold Coast in New South Wales, in Queensland, and down in a country town south of Sydney called Mittagong. And it's one of those things, again, I've mentioned this in a number of podcasts, where the best thing about it is seeing how things were in the late 1960s. So they do have a dramatic climax in a shopping centre, which was the first big shopping centre in Sydney called Roselands. So we get to see how Roselands looked in the late 1960s. There's a really nice stunt of somebody falling off a staircase onto a market stand, and a lot of running around and running up and down escalators and things like that. So, again, the movie isn't very good. And nonetheless, watching it was fun for me because I got to see a lot of places, including the Gold Coast in Queensland, the town of Mittagong, and inner city Sydney and the suburbs of Sydney, in fact, as they were half a century ago. So I watched that. What else have I watched? Watched the remake, the Eli Roth remake, of Death Wish, starring Bruce Willis, which came out last year or this year. It's kind of based on the Michael Winner, Brian Garfield, and Chuck Bronson movie back in the 70s. And it's really odd because it's got this gun nut approach, which is really fucked up. It's very right-wing in its ideology. And however, there are a couple of things, there are a couple of moments when you kind of go, yeah, Bruce Willis used to be a good actor. There are a couple of beats where he really does nail the emotional tone that it should have in that particular thing, but most of it he's just walking through. Vincent D'Onofrio's in there as well, but Elizabeth Shue plays his wife, who basically gets refrigerated very early in the piece. It's basically an unnecessary piece of cinema, really. And it's the kind of movie that's going after a certain demographic, which unfortunately would be Trump supporters and guns right advocates of all kinds of brain damage, and didn't enjoy it a hell of a lot. So that's pretty much all that I've seen. So I have watched a lot of YouTube videos and some episodic TV, which I won't talk about. So when I get back from this break, I'm going to talk about the first of the movies, 1958 original version of The Fly, with a script by Australian writer James Clavell, directed by Kurt Newman, starring Vincent Price and David Hedison, and based on a short story by George Langerlands.
Will everyone in the theatre hold on firmly to his seat, please? Stop it! Stop it! I'm Vincent Price. What unearthly horror did that girl gaze upon? What manner of incredible thing walked beneath that hood? It would be unfair at this time to show you any more of what went on in that laboratory where a man actually dared to play God. So fantastic, words can't begin to describe it. You must see it with your own eyes to believe it. When the fly comes your way.
It isn't like any other fly I've ever seen.
I've killed Andre. Please help me. Call the police and...
The charge can only be murder.
There were no mistresses. I had no lovers.
Why did you kill him?
God, don't let it get out.
Inspector. Inspector, it's in the garden. Come quickly.
As God is my witness, I saw the thing. It's unbelievable. I shall never forget that scream as long as I live.
The fly is on its way. Watch out for it. It's far beyond anything your mind could ever conceive.
Okay, so The Fly is an iconic science fiction movie. There's no going around it. Even more so than the David Cronenberg remake in the 80s, the first version of The Fly, directed by Kurt Newman, with a script by James Clavell, who also went on to write Shogun, starring Vincent Price, Herbert Marshall, David Hedison. We all know that part of it. It's really like up there with Forbidden Planet and other iconic movies of the genre. The more interesting thing about The Fly, which was first published, by the way, in the 1957 issue of Playboy, so we also have Hugh Hefner to thank for it, is George Langerland, who wrote the thing, because George Langerland was a really deeply interesting guy. He wrote short stories mostly, but before he wrote short stories, he was a spy during World War II for the Special Operations Executive, the same mob who hired Christopher Lee. They were deep cover spies. They'd go behind enemy lines, liaise with the French resistance, and basically risk their lives every day they were working. In fact, Langerland was captured by the Germans on the 6th of October in 1941 and escaped on the 16th of July 1942 from the Morzac camp in France. He got a French Croix de Guerre for his efforts during the war. He's the only science fiction writer I know who got a Croix de Guerre. If you want to know more about the Special Operations Executive, just go into Wikipedia. There's an extensive Wikipedia archive on it, and it's a really interesting thing. With Langerland, though, because he had some distinctive facial features, including big ears, he actually had to undergo plastic surgery before being dropped into France by parachute, because if you see a guy walking around with distinctive facial features, the Germans may make note of that. And if somebody says, hey, there was a big-eared guy spying on this or that, it makes them more of a risk to being caught by the Germans. So he actually had to have plastic surgery on his ears, amongst other facial features, in order to be a part of the war effort, which is kind of interesting and cool. But enough about him. If you have a look at the original story upon which The Fly was based and the original 1958 movie, they're almost exactly the same. It's a perfect replication of the original story. You got Francois Delambre, in this case played by Vincent Price, being woken up by a phone call. His sister-in-law, Helene, is calling him to say that she's killed his brother, her husband, and that he should call the police. The police come, there's an investigation. A hydraulic press has been dropped onto his brother's head and arm. And the whole movie plays out, and the story plays out, almost as a police procedural at the start, which is kind of an interesting approach to take for a science fiction movie. They don't drop you into the science fiction straight away. They let you realize that something's gone drastically wrong. They introduce you to the main characters, Helene, Francois, and Andre, played by David Hedison in this case. And they then tell you what actually happened in flashback. And I really like that approach. I think it makes it much more accessible. You kind of take a side lane off the highway and suddenly it slowly but gradually takes you into a very strange place. But it's very kind of accessible in that sense. And in the 1950s, science fiction wasn't the most popular genre in the world as it is now. And so having something a little more prosaic as an introduction really worked to get this movie a larger audience. By the way, from here on, there'll be spoilers. So if you haven't seen this movie for some reason, you've been in a cave since birth or part of a religious cult that eschewed movies, watch the movie and then come back, or at least look at the Wikipedia page of the movie. There are a couple of things about it that are really interesting. My reading of Vincent Price's character, Francois, is that he's gay. People say he's actually in love with Helene in the first two movies. In fact, Vincent Price does reprise the role in the second movie, Return of the Fly. But Price's innate campiness and the fact that he's not married and he's devoted to his brother's family can be read as the character being a closeted gay man. And I kind of like that interpretation of it. I don't really like that cliche of a guy being in love with his brother's wife, that kind of thing, particularly when in the context of the movie there's no payoff to that. It's a much more reasonable reading to me that Francois is gay. And Andre isn't necessarily a particularly nice character in this movie too, by the way. David Hedison's character. He's obsessed with his work to the point where he basically ignores his family to a big extent. He loves them, but he's kind of obsessed with the work. He and his wife go to a ballet, and he starts writing formulas on the program for the ballet and that kind of thing. He's really quite monomaniacal about this device he's building in the family's engineering works. And the device is a teleportation machine, or more correctly, as my good friend Sean Williams will tell you, what he's creating is actually a murdering twin maker. It kills you and then creates an exact twin of you somewhere else because it disintegrates you. It's even called in the movie a disintegrate integrator. But I kind of like the term murdering twin maker because it's more accurate, and it also covers the kind of shit you get in Star Trek where people get teleported to planetary surfaces and things like that. Basically, what it's doing is killing you and making a duplicate of you, which makes the movie even creepier than it already is. We just also see some of Andre's earlier experiments where there's a little plate made in Japan that he teleports, and he does an experiment on the family cat because he's a prick. And the experiment with the cat goes wrong, and you hear an echoey cat meowing in the ether after the cat doesn't rematerialize. Now, here is where the story and the original movie split a bit, because when Andre materializes in the original story, not only does he have bits of his body mixed up with those of the fly, big spoiler there, but he also has bits of cat in his body makeup as well, which is even creepier.
but they didn't put that into the movie for some reason. And I think it makes a much better story than just the fly bits. The fact that the cat was somewhere in the system and his body was integrated with parts of the cat makes it as creepy as fuck. And in doing so, it's much better. The makeup for the fly is really great. The big fly head and the claw are very effective. The reveal is nicely done. I really liked that part. And the acting, for the most part, is really great. We've got a few character actors in there who are kind of interesting. The ensemble isn't that big. You got Herbert Marshall playing Inspector Shiraz, who's the policeman. And Herbert Marshall was an actor with a long and distinguished career on the stage and also in cinema, of course. His full name was Herbert Bruff Falcon Marshall. I like the idea of Falcon Marshall being the name for an actor, but yeah, he was born in 1890 and he lost a leg in World War I, which is why you're seeing him walking with a cane partly in this movie. And in spite of that, he became a bit of a heartthrob in the early 1930s. In cinema, he did a movie called Trouble in Paradise with Miriam Hopkins. The fact that he was asymmetrical, let's say, didn't really affect his career. He was in a movie called The Good Fairy in 1935. He was in The Letter in 1940. He did a lot of radio work. And he was also in Duel in the Sun in 1946. So, yeah, and he also did a lot of work after World War II with amputee soldiers. So he kind of visited military hospitals and raised money to help amputee soldiers as well. So all credit to Herbert Marshall, much deeper guy than just seeing a few of his movies would suggest. And I kind of like that about him. We also have Kathleen Freeman turning up as the maid to the family. Now, Kathleen Freeman, fantastic actor. She's known mostly for a couple of things, even though she had a long and distinguished career. She was in The 7-Year Itch, for instance, Artists and Models with Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, North to Alaska. She did The Nutty Professor. But people remember her most for playing the Penguin in The Blues Brothers. But before that, she had a great career. She was in The Bad and the Beautiful as well, which is one of my favourite movies of all time. So Kathleen Freeman turns up as the maid in a totally wasted role. I really like her as an actor, and I like the kinds of characters she played. She did play a wide range of characters rather than being kind of bottled into one particular type, because she wasn't a particularly beautiful woman, in a physical sense at least. Yeah, those kind of roles were the kind of roles that she had. Now, this movie has a great look about it too. It's in widescreen CinemaScope, so it looks fantastic on my big screen. It's I love the lab equipment as well, the neon tubing in there, the throbbing, pulsing electronic sound of the equipment, the fact that you've got to put on dark glasses because there's a great big flash of light as things teleport. It's got all of those kind of groovy, atom punk kind of tropes about it, which make it a really good film. Now, like a lot of science fiction and horror movies, and it does cross that divide of the 1950s, it also has an overarching theme of threat to the family unit. You've got almost a perfect family. You've got a father and mother who love their son. They love each other. They're quite well off, which is an aspirational kind of thing. And suddenly, because of a technological glitch and a technological innovation, which is a misguided attempt to make the world a better place, even though what he's creating, of course, is the murdering twin maker, the technology and, in a sense, the monster, who is part Andre and part Fly, are a threat to the smooth and seamless and happy family unit. By the way, the lab in this movie, and I'm jumping around a little bit, and I apologize for that, they created a lab for $28,000 out of a budget of somewhere around $350,000 out of army surplus equipment, which is kind of cool. Getting a whole bunch of army surplus gear, whacking a few neon tubes on it, and turning it into a science fiction set is a cool, cool thing. Strangely enough, David Hedison was very early in his career, and he's actually credited as Al Hedison in this particular movie. But they were trying to get Michael Rennie or Rick Jason, who was later in Combat, and Rick Jason was in a movie I mentioned earlier in this podcast. But they couldn't get him, so they got David Hedison. Apparently, the Fly's Head, and I'm just reading off Wikipedia here as I talk, the Fly's Head weighed 20 pounds, and Hedison said it was trying to act in it was like trying to play the piano with boxing gloves on. And I can understand that. You're not really going to get much dialogue there. He communicates through a typewriter and through scribbled notes on paper. So it didn't even really need to be David Hedison in the Fly costume for that matter, though from what I understand, it very much was. Maybe that was a good thing too, because the physicality of an actor sometimes, if you have somebody else when they're doing a monster thing in the costume, you lose that kind of gait recognition that you get from having the same guy doing both things. And this movie was a fairly quality product, even though it was Fox made it for $320. For some, the budget's a bit moot. It's somewhere between $325,000 and $495,000. So it wasn't a cheap movie. Made $3 million back, so they definitely got their bait back when they threw that hook in the water. Now, in the original story, the ending's a bit different. The iconic ending that we have in the movie of The Fly didn't happen in the original story. Instead, we have Francois telling Inspector Charras that he found the white-headed fly and buried it at his brother's grave. So it was kind of done off camera in the story, but it's kind of fitting now. I kind of like that ending better than I like the iconic ending of the movie that we have, even though there is a campy eeriness about it. And in fact, Herbert Marshall and Vincent Price had to do about 20 takes of that ending because it was just so absurd. They were giggling all the way through it. Now, I'll play you the audio from that one now just to remind you. I know that you know all know what it is, but I kind of like that. And then the thing to pay attention to in this clip as well is Paul Sortel's music. It's quite good. Paul Sortel did a whole bunch of music for people like Irwin Allen in the 1960s, for instance. He did a lot of the music for Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, amongst other things. And I think his music for The Fly is pretty effective, particularly in this scene. You can kind of speculate on whether having an end part more in tune with the original story might have made the movie a bit more seriously received than it was. But, yeah, it's kind of, I would have liked to have seen alternate endings to this one. It's not something I usually say, but I kind of would have liked to have seen, say, Vincent Price burying a shoebox at his brother's grave, or a matchbox at his brother's grave, and quietly standing there with his head bowed. I think that would have made the movie a much more serious one in a lot of ways, I suppose. But for me, yeah, it's a kind of arguable point that the original ending to the story is a better one. But I suppose this was a time when science fiction in cinema wasn't taken seriously. So going for the schlocky ending was probably the right move for the market at the time. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now. When I get back, I'm going to talk about the sequel, which is in a kind of fucked up and strange way, almost a remake of the original The Fly, and that is the 1959 black and white, but still widescreen sequel, Return of the Fly, starring Brett Halsey and Vincent Price once more.
Listen. Do you hear? It's coming back, turning the screen into a buzzing, crawling, creeping nightmare of terror. This is the son of the original fly, daring to explore the forbidden science of transmigration that brought horrible death to his father.
You look as if you've just seen a ghost, old man.
It was the fly.
Fear that will fasten its choking grip on you as his weird experiments spawn the twisted monstrosities of a living hell. The rat man whose hands and feet are changed to paws. The living corpse who rose from his coffin. And the return of the fly, seeking revenge with a thousand eyes, smashing anything that stands in his way.
Suppose he does come here. What if Philippe does not have the mind of a human, but the murderous brain of the fly?
Then he will have to be destroyed.
You'll notice they didn't get Vincent Price to do that trailer. They got Paul Frees instead. But anyway, Return of the Fly was a 1959 sequel to The Fly, made about a year and a bit afterwards. It was directed by a guy called Edward Burns, who has the dubious distinction of having been nominated for an Oscar by accident. I kid you not. He was nominated in 1955 for the screenplay to High Society by accident because they wanted to do the screenplay for the famous movie High Society with Louis Armstrong, Grace Kelly, Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby in it. But because someone fucked up at the Academy, they gave the nomination to Burns and Jerome Gottler for a movie called High Society, which was actually a Hans Hall and Leo Gorcey Bowery Boys movie, which gets, for some reason, a 7 on IMDb. Graciously, Burns and his collaborator declined the nomination so that they could fix things up, but it actually stays on the record that they were nominated for an Oscar, oddly enough. He directed a bunch of films, none of which was particularly wonderful. He did a whole bunch of the Bowery Boys movies. He did a movie called World Without End, Three Stooges in Orbit, Three Stooges Meet Hercules. Let's see, High School Hellcats, Queen of Outer Space, Space Master X7. So, yeah, he was very much a kind of B or C level director, and he got the gig for The Return of the Fly. He also wrote the screenplay for it. Of course, the movie was made fairly quickly to capitalize on the success of the original. It stars Vincent Price as Francois again, and Brett Halsey as the grown-up child that we see in the first Fly, Philippe Delorme. Brett Halsey was a kind of jobbing actor. He's still around, I believe, yep. He was one of those 1950s, 1960s pretty boy actors who really didn't get a long-term career. In fact, yeah, I apologise, he has. He was actually in a movie in 2015 called Risk Factor, and in 2013 Club Utopia, so he has had a long career. My mistake, he was actually in The Godfather Part 3 as well, which is a bit of a surprise because he doesn't really impress me as a particularly gifted thespian, if you know what I mean. So he plays the son of Andre, who gets together all of his father's old equipment in the basement of the family home and decides he's going to make the experiments work. He's got a friend, an English guy called Alan Hines, who he takes away from the family company, Delorme Frères, and they start putting the equipment back together in the basement because he wants his father's work to continue, and what could possibly go wrong? Of course, things do go wrong. They use the machinery in a slightly different way than they do in the first film, in the sense that they can store whatever they're teleporting in the machine before they rematerialize it. They only seem to have one of the cabinets, so they can dematerialize, store the pattern for whatever it is that they've dematerialized and rematerialized it in the usual murdering twin maker method. And again, here come the spoilers. What Philippe doesn't know is that his friend Alan is actually an English guy called Ronald Holmes, who has a murder warrant out on him in England, and he's doing a bit of industrial espionage to sell the technology for dematerializing and rematerializing people through a very dodgy mortician called Max Bartold, played by a character called Dan Seymour. His face is very familiar to people who know movies of the 60s and 70s. He's turned up in a lot of things. So Alan, who for some reason seems to have Lawrence Talbot's wolf-headed cane up with him for no good reason, knocks Philippe out and decides to store him in the cabinet and in the teleportation machine for later disposal. What he doesn't know, of course, is that there was a fly in the cabinet along with Philippe. And so we get the return of the fly because Philippe turns up as a guy with a giant fly head, a fly arm, and a fly foot. Now, the head's much bigger and different than the one in the original movie and looks slightly better in some ways, but also worse in some ways. It's got a little proboscis thing, but the much larger head I kind of like. Of course, we have Vincent Price on hand again, but he doesn't get given too much to do except worry about things and liaise with the police. Philippe's mother, Helene, has conveniently died, and we do see Vincent Price in voiceover mourning her and saying that he loved her and all that kind of thing, but basically he's closeted, so that's not true. We have a very cursory love interest for Philippe, a girl called Cecile, played by Danielle Demetz. And, yeah, it's kind of there just to tick the box. There's really no rapport between them. There are no meaningful interactions between them as a couple particularly. The movie runs 80 minutes, so maybe they've cut out a couple of scenes to give it a tight running time. But it is very cursory, that kind of love interest. So there are a couple of things that happen after Philippe gets rematerialized as Philippe Fly and runs away into the back lots of Hollywood. Actually, no, I'm getting the timeline wrong. The industrial spy, Ronald Holmes, gets found out by an English investigator. And so he stores the English investigator in the system, not realizing that they already have a guinea pig in there. So the guy rematerializes with giant guinea pig hands, and the guinea pig rematerializes with human hands. And so Alan squishes the guinea pig and dumps the guy into the St. Lawrence River in a car with his hamster hand, with his guinea pig hands intact. So Francois, played by Vincent Price, does get something to do eventually, which is to find the fly, along helped out by Inspector Beecham, played by John Sutton, who's the copper. They couldn't get Herbert Marshall again. He was ill at the time, though he was willing to do this particular movie. So they've got to find the fly, which has got Philippe's head. And there is a process shot of the fly with Philippe's head, which is done very marginally and very unfortunately. I've actually got a model about, you know, a foot tall of the return of the fly, and it's got the fly man with the fly arm and the fly foot, and it's got a tiny little Philippe fly next to it as well. Picked it up really cheaply at Pop Culture. But it kind of disposed me more kindly towards this movie that I've got a piece of merch from the movie sitting up above the big screen TV, along with a lot of other things, including the bride from Kill Bill without her sword because I got it cheap without the sword, and a whole bunch of other stuff, including various pop vinyls of Chinese Hopping Vampires and all sorts of other weird shit that I've got around the place. But I digress. Now, does this movie actually work? It kind of does, in the sense that it extends the mythology of the trilogy a little bit. I think it's very much a rush job, and I think it's very much a cash cow to kind of cash in on the popularity of the first one. It didn't do particularly badly at the box office, but it didn't do fantastically well either, which is a bit of a problem, and which is a reason, of course, why it took 6 years to do a sequel to this one. There are some continuity errors between the first and the second movie as well. The fact that the original laboratory wasn't in the family home, but at de Lomfray's factory, is kind of brushed over in this one, and for some reason, suddenly it's in the basement of the house. They reused a lot of the lab equipment, set from the first one for the second one, which does give it a kind of visual continuity. That would have been nice if it had been made in colour, because I think that particularly given the script isn't quite as good as the first one, having that colourfulness of the lab equipment and kind of zhuzhing things up a little bit by doing that might well have helped the movie. But the budget was $225,000, so it wasn't, it was within the ballpark of the first film. But it does have a much cheaper production look than the first one does, which is a little bit unfortunate. The other difference, too, is that they didn't use Brett Halsey to play the fly, to play Philippe Fly. They had an actor called Ed Wolfe, who was 7'4", because they wanted the monster to be very, very tall. Ed Wolfe was also the actor that played the Colossus of New York in 1958 and was in Invaders from Mars from 1953 as well. I think he was mostly hired because of his height. He didn't get a hell of a lot of roles. From between 1925 and 1959, there were about a dozen roles, mostly as mutant, giant, the robot, tall man, and that kind of thing. So he was very much stereotyped because of his physicality. But they wanted the monster to be tall for some reason, so they got Ed Wolfe to do that. Dan Seymour as a mortician gets a couple of good scenes. He was also in a bunch of Humphrey Bogart movies, by the way. I was just looking up Dan Seymour. He was in Casablanca, Key Largo, and To Have and Have Not. And a lot of people confuse this Dan Seymour with the announcer who did Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast, but they're two separate people. He's the kind of character actor that you see playing a bad guy in a fez in various B pictures in the 1950s and the 1940s. In conclusion for Return of the Fly, I'm glad I saw it. I think that it kind of works to give us the next generation of this particular saga. It's silly, and it embraces the silliness a lot more than the first film did. The guinea pig mutation kind of lifts it a little bit just when it gets a prosaic, and a lot of it is just, you know, a bunch of people in a room talking. And so it does give us that sense of what the fuck that this kind of movie really does need to make it work. And it's also interesting to compare and contrast sequels these days with sequels in those days. And I think sequels are taken much more seriously these days, and people try to up the ante in sequels much more than they did in those days. So if you get a sequel to a quite popular movie these days, you know that the audience is going to expect things to be bigger, brighter, and nastier in some cases than the first one, whereas these ones were just churned out without too much thought of the future, knowing that they'll get a certain amount of audience because it is a sequel to a very successful movie. So I'm going to take a break now, and then we're going to get to the weirdest of the three in some ways, the 1965 sequel to the 1958 and the 1959 Fly movies, Curse of the Fly, which stars Brian Donlevy, Carol Gray, and George Baker. And here is a trailer. I'm sorry about the audio.
The terror shot that can't be stopped.
You're not God. You're not even human. You murdered those men, and you made me a murderer, too.
Weird experiments of accursed scientists turn human beings into living hybrid hell monsters. Now you hold hands with the devil. Now you run. Run for your life from the terror, the torment, the torture inflicted by Satan's ambassador of evil. The next victim could be you. Or you. Or you. Caught forever by the curse of the fly.
Okay, so this 1965 one was made in the UK. It wasn't made in the US as the previous two were. It was still distributed by Fox. Had a budget of $90,000, which is a great big drop from the previous movie in the series. It was directed by an Australian guy. The guy was born in Tasmania in Hobart, which is also the birthplace of Errol Flynn. A guy called Don Sharp, who made some interesting movies in his career and did a lot of television episodes as well. Don Sharp made things like The Face of Fu Manchu with Christopher Lee, Rasputin the Mad Monkey made that for Hammer, The Brides of Fu Manchu. Let's see, that really weird 1973 bikie movie in England, Psychomania. Did some episodes of Callan. Made Bear Island based on an Alistair MacLean movie. Did a whole bunch of episodic TV as well. He did Devil Ship Pirates for Hammer as well. He was better than the material in this case. I like Don Sharp's work a lot. The producer for this one was a guy called Robert L. Lippitt, who bounced between between America and the UK, doing all sorts of film projects. He was very much a schlocky kind of guy. He was an uncredited producer, for instance, on the Quatermass Experiment, and also The Last Man on Earth, the Italian-based version of I Am Legend with Vincent Price in it. Did a movie called Witchcraft, The Earth Dies Screaming, which is a 1964 English alien invasion movie, which is quite interesting. He also did the really weird kind of reboot of the Mr. Moto series in 1965, The Return of Mr. Moto, which starred Henry Silver. And a shout out to the Silver and Gold podcast guys for that one. The only real thing he did of any great value was he was the producer who gave Samuel Fuller a shot in movies like The Steel Helmet and a couple of other films, including Baron of Arizona. He gave Sam Fuller directing and writing credits on those and didn't pay him any money, but he said, I'm going to give you a foot in the door of the business, so make these movies and you know, you've got your foot in the door. And Sam Fuller did that and went on to make all of the movies for which we know him and love him for. So all credit to Lippitt for that one thing. Now, this movie is really weird. It stars Brian Donlevy, who was played Quatermass in the second Quatermass movie, I believe. An actress called Carol Gray, who was beautiful and gets the chance to show it in this film. And the English actor George Baker trying very, very unsuccessfully to do a North American accent. Now, the movie starts out with what Don Sharp has said himself is some of the best footage he ever shot, which is a woman called Patricia Stanley escaping from a mental hospital wearing a bra and panties and then running through the night in the forest until she meets Martin Delon, played by George Baker, who picks her up and takes her to his hotel and gets her a room at his hotel, and they kind of fall in love and get married. The footage of Carol Gray running through the forest is in some ways quite reminiscent of Eyes Without a Face, Yeux Sans Visage, the famous French horror movie from a few years before. It's very much got that kind of weird filmed at night eeriness about it, and it is quite an effective little pre-title sequence to the movie, and nothing after it really in any meaningful way lives up to it. Martin Delon is supposed to be the grandson of the original André Delon from the first movie, but the continuity in this movie is totally fucked because rather than being Philippe's father as Henri, played by Brian Donlevy, in the usual kind of toupee-wearing, heavy-set, better get him to do the acting in the morning because he's going to be drunk by lunchtime, Brian Donlevy style. And at this point, again, spoilers, the movie turns into a gothic horror film as much as it is a piece of science fiction. And it gets severely fucked up because there are a few things going on, and I'm going to tell you what they are. You've got to see this movie, but me telling you what they are isn't really going to mess it up for you. For a start, Martin has inherited part of the fly DNA from his father, ostensibly Philippe, but in this case Henri. We'll just say Mr. Delon Sr. Problem is that unless he takes a certain serum at regular intervals, he starts aging rapidly. So he's got to take the serum in order to stop him from turning into an old guy prematurely, because flies have a short life cycle and are susceptible to cold. So if Martin gets too cold, this process starts and he's got to take an injection. That's one thing. The next thing is the experiments have continued. The father, with the help of both of his sons, one of whom is in London, and we never see him with any of the other actors really, except maybe Don Levy. He's played by an actor called Michael Graham, who doesn't get a lot to do really, but he's quite crucial to the denouement of this particular movie. So what they're doing is they're teleporting between Montreal, the big rambling family mansion in Montreal, and a place they have in London. Now, Brian Don Levy's character has teleported to London to help his son with that end of things, but he's got to leave London and get teleported back because his passport wasn't stamped at customs and the cops are starting to suss out what's happening a little bit. That's the story anyway. So he teleports back, but he's got horrible radiation burns on his chest because the process, even after three generations of attempts, still isn't perfect, because not only does Brian Dunleavy's character, Henri, have radiation burns, but they have three different people locked up in sheds at the back of the mansion, including Martin's wife, Judith. He's actually bigamous with Patricia Stanley, the Carol Gray character. His wife, Judith, who has a twisted hand and one half of her face is like melted wax. So when that happens, of course, what you do is you put your wife in a stable with a bolt on the door and keep her locked up there, because that's how you handle that kind of thing, of course. There are also a couple of other quite fucked up looking people, which are done quite effectively. In one case, there's a really effective little scene of one of the other two people they have locked up there, who are failed experiments of this severely fucked up and not very self-knowledgeable Delorme family. They've turned into, psychologically as much as physically, monsters because of what they're doing to make this experiment work. Not only do you have these people at the mansion, but you also have a Chinese couple. One played by Bert Kwok, who is of Chinese extraction. English actor, he had a long career until he died recently. He was actually born in Lancashire, but grew up in Shanghai when his family went back to Shanghai from Lancashire, and then was educated partly in America. But Bert Kwok's in there playing a guy called Ty, and they have a Welsh actress called Yvette Rees in Yellowface playing Wan, the female Chinese person in there. So between them, they're Tai and Wan, so it's Taiwan, which is the, you know, I suppose that's supposed to be a joke in the 1960s. But Bert Kwok gives it a good effort, and Yvette Rees, in spite of the makeup, epicanthic fold, and the Chinese wig she wears, is trying to, she looks a little bit like that movie from way back when Catherine Hepburn played a Chinese woman. I forget which one it is, but you can look it up. So they're there for no good reason apart from the fact that they needed a servant there. Now, the interesting thing about the Wan character, even though it's Yvette Rees doing Yellowface, and Yellowface is something that we now don't do for reasons of cultural and racial sensitivity, she does get a bit of an arc because she really is pissed off with what's going on in this place, and she is a supporter and an ally to the mutated wife, Judith, who is played by Mary Manson, who is locked up in the back shed. And so she lets her out now and then to play the piano, because she was a famous pianist, but she can't play the piano very well because one of her hands looks like a flipper. So the guy who's supposed to be the protagonist in this movie, George Baker's Martin Delorme, is actually a monstrously nasty piece of work and a total prick, which is something with which he has in common with his grandfather, who put the cat in the teleporter and then didn't give a fuck when the cat didn't materialize. So things start going to hell really fast. The people from the asylum are coming looking for Patricia Stanley, and Martin tells the lady from the mental hospital that he's married her and they're happy together, and yeah, piss off basically. The actress playing that woman, Madame Fournier, her name is in the movie, is actually Rachel Kempson, who who is the mother of Vanessa and Lynn Redgrave. She was married to Michael Redgrave, and she was the mother of Corin, Vanessa, and Lynn Redgrave. And she does a kind of nice job with a small role in this one. There is a little bit of good acting in it, mostly from Carol Gray, Yvette Reeves, and also Mary Manson playing Judith DeLorme. So basically that happens. Then things start getting even worse. Chinese couple let out the mutated experiments and nick off because they can't handle what this family is doing anymore. The police are starting to close in, including Inspector Charas, this time played by Charles Carlson, and Inspector Rene, played by Jeremy Wilkins. And so they decide to get rid of the evidence. What they do is they capture the two people who are not Judith, who are mutated, and decide to teleport them over to London so that the other son can get rid of the bodies. Problem is that when they get reintegrated, the two bodies are fused into a writhing mass of flesh, which the other son, Albert, has to kill because, you know, it's a kindness to do that. So that happens. And then Brian Donlevy's Henri decides to teleport over as well. And that doesn't end well for reasons I won't do a spoiler on. So things start going west. Patricia realizes that Judith is still alive. And Martin is in need of one of the potions. So the cops close in and everything goes to hell. Now, bottom line for this movie is it's severely fucked up. The people who are supposed to be the well-meaning scientists in an arc from the first movie to the third have turned into cruel, nasty monsters. And this is the only movie in the trilogy where nobody turns into a fly, by the way. They turn into kind of mutated, waxy-faced and fucked-up-looking people, but nobody actually gets turned into a fly. The fly has been so deeply integrated into the DNA of this family that it's only by the side effects of being susceptible to cold and being susceptible to rapid aging is the way that it manifests, and also with a kind of animalistic cruelty and madness that overtakes them as time and the plot of the movie progress. So this movie is really, really fucked up for that reason. And in a weird way, that kind of makes it the most enjoyable of the trilogy in some ways, because the kind of things that go wrong just keep escalating there and roll on. And Don Sharp keeps things moving along. This one's 86 minutes, so 6 minutes longer than Return of the Fly. And it's a little, a bit shorter than the first one. But it's basically twisted and fucked up. It was written by a guy called Harry Spalding, by the way, who didn't have many screen credits apart from Surf Party in 1964, this movie, another movie called Murder Game, and the Disney movie The Watcher in the Woods. I really can't overemphasize how messed up this film really is. It's got to be seen to be believed. Of course, we then went on to get in 1986 the reboot by David Cronenberg, and then we got a sequel with Eric Stoltz in it and Daphne Zuniga soon afterwards. I haven't watched those ones lately, so I may well watch them and do them for a future podcast. But these three movies make a pretty tight trilogy, and there is a thematic progression from one to the next which make it worth revisiting and show it to be really, really fucked up. There are enough what-were-they-thinking moments in all three movies, if you come to think of it. The ending in the first one, the bit with the guinea pig in the second one, and pretty much the rear end of the third one, where you kind of go, what the fuck? There are what-the-fuck moments in all three of these movies, and they make them more enjoyable rather than less enjoyable, and that's probably something to treasure with them. So that's about it this time around. The Fly Trilogy was really fun to revisit. Watched the first one again with Sal and the second one. But the third one I watched by myself, and she's going to watch it later. And she enjoyed them both, the first two that she saw. And she's looking forward to the third one to some degree anyway. So anyway, thank you for listening. I'll be back again in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast, next week with a Paleo Cinema podcast. And I'll also be doing Love That Album, as I said, and also The Projection Booth in the very near future, and I'll let you know when that's happening. So look after yourselves. Watch bad movies, watch good movies, keep watching the skies. And as usual, to thank the Patreon supporters, including the wonderful David Cummer in Minnesota, whose name is not yet on the credits because I have been slack. Here are the credits to honour the Patreon supporters at patreon.com/paleocinema, who have, through their enormous generosity and charity, given a little bit of money to the podcast. Take care, and I'll catch you guys later. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our Foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, the second unit director, Paul, the special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our script doctor, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, the set security lead, Richard H., the set photographer, Mark D., the extra, David L., the extra, and Richard C., our transport co-captain, plus Andrew, our necessary film critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.